The general effect of the performance was much the same as that of the Davenport brothers, but it was more impressive, inasmuch as the medium was in full view, and was under control by a spectator. The hypothesis of modern psychic science, founded upon many experiments, especially those of Dr. Crawford, of Belfast, is that invisible bands of ectoplasm, which are rather conductors of force than forcible in themselves, are evolved from the body of the medium and connect up with the object to be manipulated, where they are used to raise it, or to play it, as the unseen power may desire that unseen power being, according to the present views of Professor Charles Richer, some extension of the personality of the medium, and according to the more advanced school some independent entity. Of this nothing was known at the time of the Eddies, and the phenomena presented the questionable appearance of a whole series of effects without any cause. As to the reality of the fact, it is impossible to read Alcott's very detailed description, without being convinced that there could be no error in that. This movement of objects at a distance from the medium, or telekinesis, to use the modern phrase, is now a rare phenomenon in light. But on one occasion at an amateur circle of experienced spiritualists the author has seen a large platter-shaped circle of wood in the full light of a candle, rising up on edge and flapping code answers to questions when no one was within 6 feet of it. In Horatio Eddy's Dark Stances, where the complete absence of light gave the psychic powerful scope, Alcott has testified that there were mad Indian war dances with the thudding of a dozen feet, and the wild playing of every instrument simultaneously, accompanied by yells and whoops. As an exhibition of pure brute force, he says, this Indian dance is probably unsurpassed in the annals of such manifestations. A light turned on would find all the instruments littered about the floor, and Horatio in a deep slumber, without a trace of perspiration, lying unconscious in his chair. Alcott assures us that he and other gentlemen present, whose names he gives, were permitted to sit on the medium, but that within a minute or two all the instruments were playing once again. After such an experiment all further experience and there were very many seemed to be beside the point. Short of wholesale and senseless lying on the part of Alcott and the other spectators, there can be no doubt that Horatio Eddy was exercising powers of which science was, and still is, very imperfectly acquainted. Some of Alcott's experiments were so definite, and are narrated so frankly and so clearly, that they deserve respectful consideration, and antedate the work of many of our modern researchers. For example, he brought from New York a balance which was duly tested as correct with a published certificate to that effect. He then persuaded one of the forms, the Squaw Honto, to stand upon it, the actual weights being recorded by a third person, Mr. Pritchard, who was a reputable citizen and disinterested in the matter. Alcott gives his account of the results, and adds the certificate of Pritchard as sworn to before a magistrate. Honto was weighed 4 times, standing upon the platform so that she could not ease her weight in any way. She was a woman 5 feet 3 in height, and might be expected to register about 135 ib. The 4 results were actually 88, 58, 58, and 65 ib, all on the same evening. This seems to show that her body was a mere simulacrum which could vary in density from minute to minute. It showed also what was clearly brought out afterwards by Crawford, that the whole weight of the simulacrum cannot be derived from the medium. It is inconceivable that Eddy, who weighed 179 ib, was able to give up, 88 of them, the whole circle, according to their capacity, which varies greatly, are called upon to contribute, and other elements may in all probability be drawn from the atmosphere. The highest actual loss of weight ever shown by Miss Gilliar in the Crawford experiments was 52 ib, but each member of the circle was shown by the dials on the weighing chairs to have contributed some substance to the building of the ectoplasmic formations. Colonel Alcott also prepared 2 spring balances and tested the pulling power of the spirit hands, while those of the medium were held by one of the audience. A left hand pulled with a force of 40 pounds, and the right hand with 50 in a light which was so good that Alcott could clearly see that the right hand was 1 finger short. He was already familiar with the assertion of the spirit in question that he had been a sailor and had lost a finger in his lifetime. When one reads of such things, the complaint of Ilcott that his results were not final, and that he had not perfect test conditions, becomes more and more hard to comprehend. He winds up his conclusions, however, with the words, "No matter how many skeptics came battering against these granitic facts, no matter what array of exposers might blow their tin horns and penny trumpets, that Jericho would stand." One observation which Ilcott made was that these ectoplasmic forms were quick to obey any mental order from a strong-minded sitter, coming and going as they were willed to do. Other observers in various stances have noted the same fact, and it may be taken as one of the fixed points in this baffling problem. There is one other curious point which probably escaped Ilcott's notice. The mediums and the spirits who had been fairly amiable to him during his long visit turned suddenly very acid and repellent. This change seems to have occurred just after the arrival of Madame Blavatsky, with whom Ilcott had struck up a close comradeship. Madame was, as stated, an ardent spiritualist at the time, but it is at least possible that the spirits may have had foresight, and that they sensed danger from this Russian lady. Her theosophical teachings, which were put forward in a year or two, were to take the shape that, although the phenomena were real, the spirits were empty astral shells, and had no true life of their own. Whatever the true explanation, the change in the spirits was remarkable. So far from the importance of my labor being recognized and all reasonable facilities afforded, I was kept constantly at a distance, as though I were an enemy instead of an unprejudiced observer. Colonel Ilcott narrates many cases where the sitters have recognized spirits, but too much stress should not be laid upon this, as with a dim light and an emotional condition it is easy for an honest observer to be mistaken. The author has had the opportunity of gazing into the faces of at least 100 of these images, and he can only recall 2 cases in which he was absolutely certain in his recognition. In both these cases the faces were self-illuminated, and he had not to depend upon the red lamp. There were 2 other occasions when, with the red lamp, he was morally certain, but in the vast majority of cases it was possible, if one allowed one's imagination to work, to read anything into the vague molds which rose before one. It is likely that this occurred in the Eddy Circle indeed. C. Massey, a very competent judge, sitting with the Eddies in 1875, complained of their fact. The real miracle consisted not in the recognition but in the presence of the figure at all. There can be no doubt that the interest aroused by the press accounts of the Eddy phenomenon might have caused a more serious treatment of psychic science, and possibly advanced the cause of truth by a generation. Unhappily, at the very moment when the public attention was strongly drawn to the subject, there came the real or imaginary scandal of the Holmeses at Philadelphia, which was vigorously exploited by the materialists, helped by the exaggerated honesty of Robert Dale Owen. The facts were as follows. 2 mediums in Philadelphia, Mr. and Mrs. Nelson Holmes, had given a series of stances at which an alleged spirit had continually appeared, which took the name of Katie King, and professed to be the same as that with which Professor Crookes had experimented in London. On the face of it, the assertion seemed most doubtful, since the original Katie King had clearly stated that her mission was ended. However, apart from the identity of the spirit, there seemed to be good evidence that the phenomenon was genuine and not fraudulent, for it was most fully endorsed by Mr. Dale Owen, General Lippitt, and a number of other observers, who quoted personal experiences which were entirely beyond the reach of imposture. There was in Philadelphia at the time a Dr. Child, who plays a very ambiguous part in the obscure events which followed. Child had vouched for the genuine character of these phenomena in the most pronounced way. He had gone so far as to state in a pamphlet, published in 1874, that the same John and Katie King, whom he had seen in the stance room, had come to him in his own private offices and had the dictated particulars of their earth life, which he duly published. Such a statement must raise grave doubts in the mind of any psychic student, for a spirit form can only manifest from a medium, and there is no indication that Child was one. In any case, one would imagine that, after such an assertion, Child was the last man in the world who could declare that the stances were fraudulent. Great public interest had been aroused in the stances by an article by General Lippitt in the Galaxy of December, 1874, and another by Dale Owen in the Atlantic Monthly of January, 1875. Then suddenly came the crash. It was heralded by a notice from Dale Owen, dated January 5, to the effect that evidence had been laid before him which compelled him to withdraw his previous expressions of confidence in the Holmeses. A similar card was issued by Dr. Child, writing to Alcott, who after his ED investigation was recognized as an authority. Dale Owen said, "I believe they have been latterly playing us false, which may be only supplementing the genuine with the spurious, but it does cast a doubt on last summer's manifestations, so that I shall probably not use them in my next book on spiritualism. It is a loss, but you and Mr. Crookes have amply made it up." Dale Owen's position is clear enough, since he was a man of sensitive honor, who was horrified at the idea that he could for one instant have certified an imposture to be a truth. His error seems to have lain in acting upon the first breath of suspicion instead of waiting until the facts were clear. Dr. Child's position is, however, more questionable, for if the manifestations were indeed fraudulent, how could he possibly have had interviews with the same spirits alone in his own private room? It was asserted now that a woman, whose name was not given, had been impersonating Katie King at these stances, that she had allowed her photograph to be taken and sold as Katie King, that she could produce the robes and ornaments worn by Katie King at the stances, and that she was prepared to make a full confession. Nothing could appear to be more damning and more complete. It was at this point that Alcott took up the investigation, and he seems to have been quite prepared to find that the general verdict was correct. His investigation soon revealed some facts, however, which threw fresh lights upon the matter and proved that psychic research, in order to be accurate, should examine exposures with the same critical care that it does phenomena. The name of the person who confessed that she had personated Katie King was revealed as Eliza White. In an account of the matter which she published, without giving the name, she declared that she had been born in 185R, which would make her 23 years of age. She had married at 15 and had one child 8 years old. Her husband had died in 1872, and she had to keep herself and child. The Holmeses had come to lodge with her in March, 1874. In May they engaged her to personate a spirit. The cabinet had a false panel at the back through which she could slip, clad in a muslin robe. Mr. Dale Owen was invited to the stances and was completely taken in. All this caused violent twinges of her own conscience which did not prevent her from going to greater lengths and learning to fade away or form by the help of black cloths, and finally, of being photographed as Katie King. One day, according to her account, there came to her performance a man named Leslie, a railroad contractor. This gentleman showed his suspicions, and at a subsequent interview taxed her with her deceit, offering her pecuniary aid if she would confess to it. This she accepted, and then showed Leslie the methods of her impersonation. On December 5, a mock stance was held at which she rehearsed her part as played in the real stances, and this so impressed Dale Owen and also Dr. Child, both of whom were present, that they issued the notices in which they recanted their former belief, a recantation which was a staggering blow to those who had accepted Dale Owen's previous assurances, and who now claimed that he should have made some thorough investigation before issuing such a document. It was the more painful as Dale Owen was 73 years of age, and had been one of the most eloquent and painstaking of all the disciples of the new dispensation. Alcott's first task was to sift the record already given, and to get past the anonymity of the authoress. He soon discovered that she was, as already stated, Mrs. Eliza White, and that, though in Philadelphia, she refused to see him. The Holmeses, on the other hand, acted in a very open manner towards him and offered him every facility for examining their phenomena with such reasonable test conditions as he might desire. An examination of the past life of Eliza White showed that her statement, so far as it concerned her own story, was a tissue of lies. She was very much older than stated, not less than 35, and it was doubtful whether she had ever been married to White at all. For years she had been a vocalist in a traveling show. White was still alive, so there was no question of widowhood. Alcott published the certificate of the chief of the police to that effect. Among other documents put forward by Colonel Alcott was one from the Mr. Allen, Justice of the Peace of New Jersey, given under oath. Eliza White, according to this witness, was so untruthful that those to whom she spoke never knew when to believe her, and her moral reputation was as bad could be. Judge Allen was able, however, to give some testimony which bore more directly upon the matter under discussion. He deposed that he had visited the Holmeses in Philadelphia, and had assisted Dr. Child to put up the cabinet, that it was solidly constructed, and that there was no possibility of any entrance being effected from behind, as alleged by Mrs. White. Further, that he was at a stance at which Katie King appeared, and that the proceedings had been disturbed by the singing of Mrs. White in another room, so that it was quite impossible that Mrs. White could, as she claimed, have acted an impersonation of the spirit. This being a sworn deposition by a justice of the peace would seem to be a weighty piece of evidence. This cabinet seems to have been made in June, for General Lippitt, an excellent witness, described quite another arrangement on the occasion when he experimented. He says that two doors folded backwards, so as to touch each other, and the cabinet was simply the recess between these doors with a board over the top. The first two or three evenings I made a careful examination, and once with a professional magician, who was perfectly satisfied that there was no chance of any trick. This was in May, so the two descriptions are not contradictory, save to Eliza White's claim that she could pass into the cabinet. In addition to these reasons for caution in forming an opinion, the Holmeses were able to produce letters written to them from Mrs. White in August, 1874, which were quite incompatible with there being any guilty secret between them. On the other hand, one of these letters did relate that efforts had been made to bribe her into a confession that she had been Katie King. Later in the year, Mrs. White seems to have assumed a more threatening tone, as is sworn by the Holmeses in a formal affidavit, when she declared that unless they paid a rent which she claimed, there were a number of gentlemen of wealth, including members of the Young Men's Christian Association, who were ready to pay her a large sum of money, and she need not trouble the Holmeses anymore. $1,000 was the exact sum which Eliza White was to get, if she would consent to admit that she impersonated Katie King. It must surely be conceded that this statement, taken in conjunction with the woman's record, makes it very essential to demand corroboration for every assertion she might make. One culminating fact remains. At the very hour that the bogus stance was being held at which Mrs. White was snowing how Katie King was impersonated, the Holmeses held a real stance, attended by 20 people, at which the spirit appeared the same as ever. Colonel Alcott collected several affidavits from those who were present on this occasion, and there can be no doubt about the fact. That of Dr. Adolphus Felger is short, and may be given almost in full. He says under oath that he has seen the spirit known as Katie King in all perhaps 80 times, is perfectly familiar with her features, and cannot mistake as to the identity of the Katie King who appeared upon the evening of December 5th. For while the said spirit scarcely ever appeared of exactly the same height or features two evenings in succession, her voice was always the same, and the expression of her eyes, and the topics of her conversation enabled him to be still more certain of her being the same person. This Felger was a well-known and highly respected Philadelphia physician, whose simple word, says Alcott, would outweigh a score of affidavits of your Eliza White's. It was also clearly shown that Katie King appeared constantly when Mrs. Holmes was at Blissfield and Mrs. White was in Philadelphia, and that Mrs. Holmes had written to Mrs. White describing their successful appearances, which seems a final proof that the latter was not a confederate. By this time one must admit that Mrs. White's anonymous confession is shot through and through with so many holes that it is in a sinking condition. But there is one part which, it seems to the author, will still float. That is the question of the photograph. It was asserted by the Holmesies in an interview with General Lippert, whose word is a solid patch in this general quagmire, that Eliza White was hired by Drive Child to pose in a photograph as Katie King. Child seems to have played a dubious part all through this business, making affirmations at different times which were quite contradictory, and having apparently some pecuniary interest in the matter. One is inclined, therefore, to look seriously into this charge, and to believe that the Holmesies may have been party to the fraud. Granting that the Katie King image was real, they may well have doubted whether it could be photographed, since dim light was necessary for its production. On the other hand, there was clearly a source of revenue if photographs at $0.50 each could be sold to the numerous sitters. Colonel Ilcott in his book produces a photograph of Mrs. White alongside of the one which was supposed to be Katie King, and claims that there is no resemblance. It is clear, however, that the photographer would be asked to touch up the negative so as to conceal the resemblance, otherwise the fraud would be obvious. The author has the impression, though not the certainty, that the two faces are the same with just such changes as manipulation would produce. Therefore he thinks that the photograph may well be a fraud, but that this by no means corroborates the rest of Mrs. White's narrative, though it would shake our faith in the character of Mr. and Mrs. Holmes as well as of Drive Child. But the character of physical mediums has really only an indirect bearing upon the question of the reality of their psychic powers, which should be tested upon their own merits whether the individual be saint or sinner. Colonel Ilcott's wise conclusion was that, as the evidence was so conflicting, he would put it all to one side and test the mediums in his own way without reference to what was past. This he did in a very convincing way, and it is impossible for anyone who reads his investigation, People from the Other World, p. 460 and onwards, to deny that he took every possible precaution against fraud. The cabinet was netted at the sides so that no one could enter as Mrs. White claimed to have done. Mrs. Holmes was herself put into a bag which tied round the neck and, as her husband was away, she was confined to her own resources. Under these circumstances numerous heads were formed, some of which were semi-materialized, presenting a somewhat terrible appearance. This may have been done as a test, or it may have been that the long contention had impaired the powers of the medium. The faces were made to appear at a level which the medium could in no case have reached. Dale Owen was present at this demonstration and must have already begun to regret his premature declaration. Further stances with similar results were then held in Ilcott's own rooms, so as to preclude the possibility of some ingenious mechanism under the control of the medium. On one occasion, when the head of John King, the presiding spirit, appeared in the air, Ilcott, remembering Eliza White's assertion that these faces were merely tents and masks, asked and obtained permission to pass his stick all round it. This case, as it is very typical of the way in which the public has been misled over spiritualism. The papers are full of an exposure. It is investigated and is shown to be either quite false or very partially true. This is not reported, and the public is left with the original impression uncorrected. Even now, when one mentions Katie King, one hears some critics say, "Oh, she was shown to be a fraud in Philadelphia," and by a natural confusion of thought this has even been brought as an argument against Crookes's classical experiments. The affair, especially the temporary weakening of Dale Owen, set the cause of spiritualism back by many years in America. Mention has been made of John King, the presiding spirit at the Holmes stances. This strange entity would appear to have been the chief controller of all physical phenomena in the early days of the movement, and is still occasionally to be seen and heard. His name is associated with the Coons's Music Saloon, with the Davenport Brothers, with Williams in London, with Mrs. Holmes, and many others. In person when materialized he presents the appearance of a tall, swarthy man with a noble head and a full black beard. His voice is loud and deep, while his rap has a decisive character of its own. He is master of all languages, having been tested in the most out of their way tongues, such as Georgian, and never having been found wanting. This formidable person controls the bands of lesser primitive spirits, Red Indians and others, who assist at such phenomena. He claims that Katie King is his daughter, and that he was himself when in life Henry Morgan, the buccaneer who was pardoned and knighted by Charles II and ended as governor of Jamaica. If so, he has been a most cruel ruffian and has much to expiate. The author is bound to state, however, that he has in his possession a contemporary picture of Henry Morgan and that if reliable it has no resemblance to John King. All these questions of earthly identity are very obscure. Before closing the account of Alcott's experiences at this stage of his evolution, some notice should be taken of the so-called Compton Transfiguration case, which shows what deep waters we are in when we attempt psychic research. These particular waters have not been plumbed yet, nor in any way charted. Nothing can be clearer than the facts, or more satisfactory than the evidence. The medium Mrs. Compton was shut up in her small cabinet, and thread passed through the bored holes in her ears and fastened to the back of her chair. Presently a slim white figure emerged from the cabinet. Alcott had a weighing platform provided, and on it the spirit figure stood. Twice it was weighed, the records being 77 ib. and 59 ib. Alcott then, as prearranged, went into the cabinet, leaving the figure outside. The medium was gone. The chair was there, but there was no sign of the woman. Alcott then turned back and again weighed the apparition, who this time scaled 52 ib. The spirit then returned into the cabinet from which other figures emerged. Finally, Alcott says, I went inside with a lamp and found the medium just as I left her at the beginning of the séance, with every as the author has given a point against the identity of John King with Morgan, it is only fair that he should give one which supports it and comes to him almost first, hand from a reliable source. The daughter of a recent governor of Jamaica was at a stance in London lately, and was confronted with John King. The King spirit said to her, you have brought back from Jamaica something which was mine. She said, what was it? He answered, my will. It was a fact, quite unknown to the company, that her father had brought back this document. Thread unbroken and every seal undisturbed. She sat there, with her head leaning against the wall, her flesh as pale and as cold as marble, her eyeballs turned up beneath the lids, her forehead covered with a death-like damp, no breath coming from her lungs and no pulse at her wrist. When every person had examined the threads and seals, I cut the flimsy bonds with a pair of scissors, and, lifting the chair by its back and seat, carried the cataleptic woman out into the open air of the chamber. She lay thus inanimate for 18 minutes, life gradually coming back to her body, until respiration and pulse and the temperature of her skin became normal. I then put her upon the scale. She weighed 121 pounds. What are we to make of such a result as that? There were 11 witnesses besides Alcott himself. The facts seem to be beyond dispute. But what are we to deduce from such facts? The author has seen a photograph, taken in the presence of an amateur medium, where every detail of the room has come out but the sitter has vanished. Is the disappearance of the medium in some way analogous to that? If the ectoplasmic figure weighed only 77 ib, and the medium 121 ib, then it is clear that only 44 ib of her were left when the phantom was out. If 44 ib were not enough to continue the processes of life, may not her guardians have used their subtle occult chemistry in order to dematerialize her and so save her from all danger until the return of the phantom would enable her to reassemble? It is a strange supposition, but it seems to meet the facts, which cannot be done by mere blank, unreasoning incredulity. Chapter 13, Henry Slade and Dr. Monk. It is impossible to record the many mediums of various shades of power, and occasionally of honesty, who have demonstrated the effects which outside intelligences can produce when the material conditions are such as to enable them to manifest upon this plane. There are a few, however, who have been so pretty eminent and so involved in public polemics that no history of the movement can disregard them, even if their careers have not been in all ways above suspicion. We shall deal in this chapter with the histories of Slade and Monk, both of whom played a prominent part in their days. Henry Slade, the celebrated Slate, writing medium, had been before the public in America for 15 years before he arrived in London on July 13, 1876. Colonel H. Esselcott, a former president of the Theosophical Society, states that he and Madame Blavatsky were responsible for Slade's visits to England,